Hello, I'm Ross Kamich, and welcome to How This Is Building Me, a podcast focused on the highs and lows, ups and downs, of all those involved with cancer, cancer medicine, and cancer science across the full spectrum of life's experiences. And I am thrilled to have with me my next guest, Lauren Makis. Lauren, would you care to introduce yourself in any way you see fit?
Sure. Thank you so much, Ross. Oh, well, you said it perfectly. Most people actually don't get to pronounce my name correctly. So it is Lauren Makis, and I would describe myself as a wife. I am married to my best friend. I am a mother of three beautiful children, a corporate professional, a musician. I would say I'm a health enthusiast and a person of very strong faith and spirituality. Well, I would sum up who I am.
Well, there's a great, you know, headlines which contain absolutely no information whatsoever, so we will dig into it. So what is your current job? Like the paid job as opposed to all of the other unpaid jobs.
The paid jobs. Well, the paid job that pays like health insurance and all the big bills. I work in the biopharmaceutical industry. I am what you call a global thought leader strategy lead. I'm basically a liaison between cancer physician scientists and our organization. And I create a really strong strategic partnership.
Yeah.
That's
so
the big job.
Yeah. So that's the big job. So there's this concept of the key opinion leader, or KOL, which I don't know when I first heard the expression, but it's this sort of, define what a KOL is. I mean, apart from it, what it stands for.
Sure. So I think there are different terms for it, right? Some people call it key opinion leader, key thought leader. I think it really is someone who is an expert in their field, an expert, sometimes a subject matter expert specifically, but someone who has the ability to influence data and science in the landscape, and particularly for our conversation in an oncology, a cancer science space, that really is a true leader and a pioneer in their field. Someone that is looked up to, someone that is revered in their particular profession, but someone from my perspective, from an industry that really is a leader scientifically, that has a lot of influence, whether that is within the landscape, within guidelines, really someone who's driving the field forward.
Okay, so how did a nice girl from New Hampshire end up in that job? So first of all, let's start off by saying that you're actually from New Hampshire.
I am.
Yeah.
I am. The live free or die state, right?
That's what our motto is.
Yeah, the bumper sticker is live free or die. We used to have the old man in the mountain, but he fell from the mountain many, many years ago. But yes, I hail from New Hampshire, though I am a New England girl at roots, but I live currently now in North Carolina.
Did you come from a kind of medical-ish family?
Oh, no, not at all. Not at all. Both my parents did a small, I guess, sort of tertiary education. None of them were true official, like, four-year college graduates. My father is in, like, sales and technology science, if you will. And my mother is in the educational system. So I didn't really come from any sort of science or medicine background, but I had such a passion for biological science going through my, you know, junior high school, college years, that I really wanted to pursue a field in medicine. That's really where I thought I was going to end up. And then there were different twists and turns in my life and my journey that landed me within the biopharmaceutical industry. So I started in sales. That just to keep it there.
So, yeah, well, we'll get into that because that's a fun story. So your dad, I think you told me, designs the technology for putting labels on things?
Yes. So for many, many years, like the barcodes that you see on everything that we purchase, he worked with a company for many, many years that developed the barcoding technology, and sort of he would do sales for like label and barcoding needs for other industries.
Mm-hmm. And when you say your mom was in the teaching field or the education, expand on that.
Sure. So she is a paraprofessional. So she worked with children who have special needs in a variety of different formats. And so she worked. I wasn't in the junior high school when she went back to work. But that is, she worked in the school that I grew up with, if you will. And my sister and my brother were there. But
And then you're the oldest of three?
I am the oldest of three. I have a younger sister who is a teacher. She is an elementary school education teacher, and a younger brother, my baby brother, who is in the banking and finance business now, but is a retired captain in the United States Air Force.
Great. And Okay, this is where it starts to get interesting. You go through high school, and your goal is to get to college. And which college do you enroll in?
So I am a graduate of the University of New Hampshire.
Excellent. And you went into that initially wanting to do pre-med? Is that what you'd say?
Yes. So I did all 4 years pre-med and a molecular biology program jointly.
Okay, and now I'm just going to drop the ball. So
Okay.
when did Miss America start calling?
Don't we wish? So when did Miss America start calling? So probably right prior to my entry into college was my first foray into understanding what the Miss America organization is. So for those that are listening, it is the largest scholarship program for women in the world. It is not something I grew up in. It was very much a situation of a family friend who made it a little bit of a dare, and as we joke, the dare went too far. But in all joking aside, applying to college, as most students probably even this day and age, it's very costly, and I did not have the family financial funds to be able to afford it, without having some level of scholarship. The good news is, coming out of high school, I did have, a level of academic scholarship that could help out for the first little bit. So, making a very long story short, I was approached by a family friend to enter this program. And the way the Miss America system works is every state has different ways of entry and they have local programs. And so, basically, I joined a local program. I competed in all aspects of competition. And in my very first event, managed to make it like third runner up. And so, that was a few thousand dollars of scholarship that was unexpected. And so basically, when I joined my freshman year of college at the University of New Hampshire, my parents came back to me, specifically my father, and said, "Look, we don't have the ability to send you here for 4 years without incurring like a significant amount of debt. Would you consider just trying again?" Right? This was your first time. Lo and behold, look what you did. So needless to say, I went back. I did a second local program, and I became a Miss Lakes Region, which
Yeah.
came with a lovely bit of scholarship money. And that following
22,000, I think you told me.
that was the night of Miss New Hampshire. So
Okay.
the
Oh,
local
well, I'm getting ahead of
programs,
myself. Yeah.
you're jumping ahead with all the excitement. So the local programs all have scholarship money, and that is your entry ticket into the state finals. And so Miss New Hampshire is the state finals, and that is the night that I went and competed in all phases of competition that existed at that time. And lo and behold, walked off that stage that evening with $22,000 in scholarship and a lot of wonderful in-kind gifts from sponsorship, and the ability to make my way to the Miss America program later that year.
So it is an amazing story. And it does feel like, I mean, the Miss America program is still going on, right?
It is,
But
yes.
it's been the kind of football for, various people to impose their views of, it should be more like this or more like that over the years. When you were doing it, so this was in the 90s,
This was in the
2000?
90s. So yeah, 1999,
Okay.
1998 to 2000.
And then I imagine, dads are proud of their daughters, but the idea of saying that your daughter is, Miss New Hampshire is actually pretty cool.
He has his own jacket.
That says Dad of Miss New Hampshire.
It's something like that, but it has a very large crown on it. And yeah, he wears it very proudly.
All right. Well, so we've got that aspect of your story, and then we have the other bit that from the age of 10, I think you told me you were doing musical theater.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, I've been in the arts since I was little. So, musical theater 10, played the piano since I was 8. The arts have been a big part of who I am. But it was probably high school where things really started to take off from a professional performance perspective. And then, really, I give a lot of credit, I have to, right, to the Miss New Hampshire and the Miss America organization, because having that ability and sort of that, I guess, limelight in being the spokesperson for my particular state opened up a significant amount of doors from a performance standpoint. And so I really sort of made my foray into professional performing and a wide range of venues, and then started to transition into a big band swing and jazz music. And that's what I do today.
And you're a singer.
I am.
And so when you, okay, so let's come back to Miss America because it's the fun bit.
Sure.
Okay, so I looked it up. So the history of Miss America goes back to like 1920. And I think you told me it was Atlantic City, and it was just an excuse to extend out the summer season.
Absolutely.
Like, don't go home.
Come. Don't go home. Stay on the boardwalk. So it was originally a bathing beauty competition. If you look up all the old photos, you'll see that.
Well, so amazingly, they had the first one that I saw was they took these lovely ladies in their, you know, what were presumably considered skimpy in the, you know, 1920s, but looked like ridiculous, like covering every aspect of them in bathing beauty. And they were wheeled around in chairs by veterans. And it was like, that's normally it's the other way around, right? It's this sort of very weird thing that, you know, you're on display. But then that evolved into this, like you say, scholarship program. Mm-hmm. And so when you were going, you said you competed in all aspects. So for those of us who are still ignorant of what that competition is, what are those?
Yeah, so clearly it has changed now. The program has evolved from back in the 90s when I participated. But the core areas of the Miss America program have always been around interview. Interview is always probably the most significantly scored phase of competition, very high, as you can imagine, right? The representative becomes Miss America is really on a speaking tour for an entire year. So interview is a big component. The talent competition, which is very different back then than it is now, right? We're sort of in this era where everybody thinks that, you know, reality television and these talent shows, that's supposed to be what you're going to see at Miss America. And that's not necessarily sort of congruent. But there is interview, there is talent, there is the evening gown competition, which is always elegant and lovely. And at the time that I competed, it was the swimsuit competition. Now I believe it is more like lifestyle and physical fitness. But back then it was still part of the swimsuit competition.
Yeah, it looks like the swimsuit, which is probably one of the more controversial areas, sort of disappeared for a few years in the late 2010s. And then it came back, but as you say, not, but branded in a different way.
Branded in a different way. And it really is focused on sort of health and nutrition and physical fitness. And even that phase of competition is just the production is done differently. You know, you don't see women on, you know, walking the stage in swimsuits. They're very much in athletic attire and sort of showcasing their ability to be physically fit to manage the job as the, you know, incoming Miss America.
Okay. So I love the story of how you went from being Miss Lakes Region. Hold on, what was it?
That was good, Miss Lakes Region.
Yeah. It's a slightly cumbersome title. And but then, okay, so you're at this point, you're a first-year undergraduate. Is that right?
Correct. Mm-hmm.
And so you take time off and you go to the Miss New Hampshire competition itself.
Yes. So I was still in school, right? So just because you hold a local title, it was like you're balancing schoolwork. And I had a little part-time job at the university. And then I still had these commitments. So even as a local title holder, that's what you're called. So as a local title holder, I still had community service that I needed to do in the Lakes Region area. So most of my weekends were spent being parts of parades or taking some time and speaking to school children. There was a lot that I had to do from a community service person perspective, just leading up to the state program.
The speaking to the schools, had you developed your platform that you wanted to represent early, or did that kind of evolve after you got these titles?
So to enter the program, you do have to have a community service initiative. And so mine was there, but as you sort of enter and kind of move forward into the state program, and clearly from a state to a national level, the platform remains but evolves and becomes deeper and you do more work because you have more resources to support you. But I did. And so my platform issue was around a condition called attachment disorder, and not something that I spent a lot of time with school children talking about. When I would go to the schools, I would talk a lot about literacy and the importance of, you know, finding out, you know, who you want to be when you grow up and, you know, all sorts of the leadership and the mentorship that comes when speaking to school children. But from a community service perspective, I did a lot of work about trying to raise awareness, spend time with programs that were around foster care children, really trying to develop partnerships with different organizations that would help create awareness to sort of, you know, drive resources to helping out in this community service initiative.
And so let's just explain what that attachment disorder is.
Well, so at the time, and I think there's probably a lot more research that has been done now, but I first came across understanding what this disorder and maybe more sort of a condition that it is when I used to volunteer and work as a camp counselor through the YMCA, that you would come across children that would be in your work groups or the activities that you were doing that just didn't have the ability to engage like other children. And not that they were shy or that they were standoffish, but really, truly the inability to make and foster connections. And over time, you know, doing my own research and partnering with different organizations, really learning that a lot of this stems from childhood trauma, right? Children who are unable to form attachments very early on, whether maternal or paternal, in their primary caregiving situation, or children that are unfortunately within the foster care system that just don't have that bond that you need at a very early age. And so it was something that really struck me, really took to the core as a young kid, you know, understanding that why, how some children can't engage like others, and how do we resolve this? And I think even now as an adult, you look back and say, gosh, you know, are the behaviors that I do or the things that I go through in life related to, you know, what we would make a parallel to as childhood trauma?
And I think you told me your mom was in the foster system.
My mom was. She was. My mother was one of eight children, and her parents died early on, and all the children were separated. So, you know, in hindsight, I think a lot of the things that I do about building connections and networks probably go back to understanding things that she didn't have as a child growing up, and ways to sort of improve on that.
Yeah, I love the idea that eventually we'll go full circle and you'll go from, you know, the attachment disorder in children with their parents and maybe in the foster system to, you know, academics who can't make connections within the pharmaceutical industry.
Everything comes from circle.
Exactly.
It's so, you. That's great.
Exactly. Okay. So you go to the, and this is the bit. So you're still holding, and you're doing, what are you majoring at this point in your undergraduate degree?
Yeah. So my undergraduate degree remains. So what I was majoring in and what I graduated with is a degree in molecular, cellular, and developmental biology with a focus in oncogenesis.
Okay. So then you get this. So you get this ridiculously long high science, you know, title of what you're doing. And then there's one night in New Hampshire. Which city in New Hampshire was the gala where you were selected?
Manchester, New Hampshire.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And I think you told me, what are the four points of the crown? Is that what those
are? Yeah, there's four points, four pillars of the crown, and they are around scholarship, service, style, and success.
Ah, there you go. And your skill was presumably singing?
I did. So I have been a vocalist for a long time, but a vocalist with a very specific genre. Like, I really do love big band swing and jazz. And so I sang a 1942 piece called The Nightingale Sang in Berkeley Square. That was my talent.
And then you're standing on the stage. Mm-hmm. And then how does it work? I mean, we've all seen the bit where, you know, they call someone's name and then all your friends who are really pissed off that they lost have to pretend that they're excited that you've won.
Smiling.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that actually may be a fair assessment. I think you have to understand, I think there are a lot of, first of all, let me caveat, there are a lot of young women who have idolized this program for years and really grow up in the program, right? So I think there's probably some element of put your time in, right? And here I come, really not knowing much about how the program works, right? I had the basic fundamentals and I could compete in the areas of competition. And then, you know, I make this local title, I prepare for a few months, and I show up at what we call boot camp week. So you get all girls together. I think there were 23 of us, 24 of us. And for a week, we're doing everything from production to how we're going to run each particular phase of the competition. And then you get to the night before the final night. And this is really where it shows my inabilities as a dancer. The night before the final show, I fell off stage and I sprained my ankle. Again, I'm a singer, not a dancer. And it was really very traumatic, not just for me, but in hindsight for the people around me, and I didn't really understand. I would find out many, many years later that, you know, people make bets backstage and everybody talks about who their dark horse contestant was. And clearly I was the dark horse, right? The new girl who hadn't put any time in the program goes in, falls off stage, sprains her ankle, and then the next night does all phases of competition, most of them with a wrapped ankle. I had a wonderful, sister contestant who was a physical therapist. So she would wrap my ankle and then unwrap my ankle. And the judges were not told which contestant had injured themselves. Pretty clear when you see me limping across stage. But anyways, at the end, you know, they bring out all the girls and they're doing awards. And really, Ross, the only thing that was most significant to me entering this program, given how much I love to perform, was if I could walk away with a talent award, that was my win. That was it. And that's all I wanted to do. Lo and behold, I did that. and then some. So I win talent, and then they call fourth runner-up, third runner-up, second runner-up, first runner-up. And then I don't actually remember my name being called at all. I do remember contestant, I think I was contestant number 16, so I remember that. And I don't remember much of what happened after that moment. But I look at the newspapers for my reactions on the cover to take me back.
Well, so one of the things you told me is, you know, you're on stage and they stick the crown on your head, and no doubt some flowers and all that stuff. Yes. And then the world changes. It's for me, there was once a movie where this is going to sound like a little exaggerated, but I once saw a movie where they showed an execution and they had somebody who was like totally fine, and they put the bag over their head so they can't see, and then all the wool slide away and they walk them through, you know, three paces, and then they sort of hang them. And it sounded like, in a weird kind of way, it was like, okay, you win, and then you're just whisked off to things which are outside of your control. So
fair. I wouldn't.
Well, I mean, it wasn't quite as dramatic as an execution. I get that, but I mean, it was a life changing moment,
because literally that is exactly what happens. There was security. I had an executive director. I had a whole team of people. I do remember they allowed my parents, my family, to come up to the stage, and there was some like hugging, kissing, and pictures. And then it was whoosh, I was taken away. And I was taken away and escorted outside and put in a limousine because I was on my way to the after party gala, which I would do my first media interview. And I literally mean my first media interview ever. I mean, I don't know how many people can say that, you know, they speak to reporters, but when you're 19 years old, you have no idea. And so I remember being whisked away by I joke about it all the time, a very large man. He ends up being, you know, like my second father. And he was the executive director of the Miss New Hampshire organization. But he was also the leading sports editor for the New Hampshire's Union Leader newspaper, which at the time was sort of the parent supporter of the organization. And I remember getting in the car in the first thing he said to me was, well, let's toast you and have a glass of champagne. And he talked just like that. Have a glass of champagne. And I said, I can't possibly have a glass of champagne. And he would say, excuse me, but I have to say it, Jesus Christ, Lauren, why can't you have a glass of champagne? That's always how he spoke to me. And I said, well, because I can, I'm not 21. So I was such a good girl. I was not 21, I couldn't have a glass of champagne. But it did, you were correct, just to circle back to what you said. In that one moment, my entire life has changed forever, truly.
You told me he said something to you in the car about
career. I have to stop going to school.
Yeah.
Yes. So after the telling me to drink a glass of champagne and wipe my mascara and get my act together, right, there was that side of it. Then he said to me, you know, well, this is it. You know, you're done school for a year. And I think it was in that moment.
Did he say for a year, or did you just say you're done with school, period?
Done with school for a year. Like, okay. It's a one year commitment. I may have heard it as done with school forever, but done with school for the 1 year time commitment. So when I signed on and became Miss New Hampshire, right, there's a contract just like you would at any employer, right, that you sign. And I basically belong to the state of New Hampshire for that entire year. That was probably the moment that affected me the most, because I was on a trajectory. Plus, I don't like change, right? I didn't at that time. It was like, this is what I'm supposed to do. And if you tell me I'm not going to do this, there was also probably that fear and risk of, well, if I don't go back to school, will I ever get to go back to school? You know, sort of things that play in the back of your mind. But yes, I had to basically within 24 hours tell the university, like, we're pausing my time here. I will say the University of New Hampshire was massively supportive, right? You can imagine one of their own kind of now at a national level. And there was a lot that I could do to represent not just my university, but the entire state. But yes, it took a whole year off.
There was, you know, because I got to Google all of this after.
Oh, goodness.
And there's this wonderful picture, which is both, you know, of its time and also both glamorous and cringeworthy at the same time, of in a white coat sitting in a laboratory bench, but with a very obvious split skirt. It's like sexy scientist.
Well, you know, that's what I'm going for in life, right?
Yeah.
I don't think that was the goal of the photo shoot. I think it was a situation where I was already dressed in heels and in a dress as Miss New Hampshire, coming back to the university to do this interview in a lab that I actually worked in. I can't say that, you know, normally I showed up on a college campus in high heels and pantyhose with my pipettes in hand. But for that, yes. Mm-hmm.
Did they ever?
It's bringing like feminism into science.
It is. I mean, did they ever use the cliche expression brains and beauty? You know, did they? I didn't see that in the article.
No,
I'm so disappointed.
No brains and beauty, but I think, isn't it like something like Science 101 and like pageant something? I don't know. I'd have to go back and look at the article.
I can't remember. It was fun to know you now and then go back and read that and say, okay, so I know where this trajectory ultimately ended up, and it's pretty awesome. Okay, so you're Miss New Hampshire for a year, and you.
Yes.
What is that? I mean, go on. Let's dumb this down for a little. You know, what does that job entail?
Oh, gosh. It's a lot of work, physically, emotionally, mentally. So basically, I kid you not, it is a speaking tour for an entire year. I was allowed days off like you would, you know, during the week, but they may not necessarily be on a weekend, right? Because there are a lot of things that happen on a weekend, right? There could be town parades. There could be sporting events. There could be things that I need to be at. But I spent a majority of my time speaking to Congress, to speaking to leaders of the community, of business communities. I feel like I visited a lot of Chamber of Commerce areas. I did a lot of veterans organization work. I spoke to so many school-age children. That was always an amazing opportunity, but a very big diversity from, you know, real true urban areas to, you know, more rural parts of the New Hampshire state. And also, again, one of the benefits of being a state title holder that happens to be able to sing, right, as a talent, you're in high demand, right? Yeah. I was in high demand to open the national anthem for basically any event that needed me, from, like I said, from, you know, Congress situations to sporting events to the Boston Pops is one of my favorite memories, right? They're an amazing orchestra in Massachusetts. And that's probably a big turning point in my musical career.
And then after a year, you have to return to normality.
Yes.
Normality-ish.
Yeah, I don't know what it was like pre. So yes, after a year, you know, I relinquish my title. I crown my successor. And she's became a very important part of my life, you know, which I assume we'll sort of get to in that part of the story. But you crown your successor. And then, yes, I go back. I go back to being a college student who took a year off. However, because of what my background is and what my CV started to become, I was still very much in high demand for appearances. That's what we would call them, and engagements and speaking opportunities and singing events. So I don't think it ever really went back to normal.
Did it?
To normal.
Because, I mean, you finished your degree on time. I mean, after the 1 year.
A year later.
Mm-hmm. And then the pre-med moved to one side at this point.
It did. And it did. And I wouldn't necessarily say, and it wasn't probably because of the Miss New Hampshire, Miss America organization, but it was because of what I had started to do in the musical side of my life and career that kind of weighed into the decisions I made about going to medical school or finding a different career path.
So was it always kind of like Lauren, the singer who has a job to pay the bills to let you be a singer? I mean, was it a 50-50 split?
I think initially, especially when I was considering and applying, right? I went through the whole process, took my MCAT, was interviewed at medical schools. I think that was the path I thought I was supposed to take. And probably for a variety of reasons, right? I had invested so much in science. I had told people this is what I wanted to do. And I really, truly believed at the time that's what I wanted to do. And then it was really a conversation that I had with a wonderful friend who's an orthopedic surgeon who was doing a lot of my sort of med school guidance and mentorship, who sat down with me actually after he did my recommendation to one of the medical school colleges, where he said, I don't think you want to go into medicine. He's like, I know you love it. And I know that this is what you say you want to do, but I don't actually really think you want to. And he said, so what if I could show you an opportunity that allows you to use your very high science and your interest in, you know, sort of disease biology and helping patients, he said, and still allow you to do music. And his take was, if, you know, if I went to medical school, this whole other side of my life that was very active from a music perspective would probably have gotten pushed on the back burner, right? I know wonderful, talented, you know, clinicians and physicians who managed to do both. But I think really, in reality, the music would have kind of become a hobby and not as much as a focus now. And so, yeah, at the end of the day, I listened to him and he introduced me to a pharmaceutical representative. And the rest
this was a sort of part-time job you were doing, because you were doing this whilst a student. And I think you told me you were It was a surgical center? Was this a surgical
structure? Yes, yeah. So one of our sponsors, so this is how it works. Everything comes full circle. Yeah. One of the sponsors of the Miss New Hampshire program was the Bedford Ambulatory Surgical Center. So it's a surgical entity and had multiple surgeons underneath it. And I worked part-time while I was, you know, finished Miss New Hampshire, went back to school. While I was finishing my 2 years left, I worked part-time and I handled marketing for their MRI imaging department. And of course, you get to interact with all sorts of, you know, physicians that were there. And he became a really important part of my life and mentor and friend. And he was the one who kind of said, I don't think this is what you want to do.
Wow. When did you meet your husband?
Oh, I met my husband. Oh, God, this is a great 2003. So this was right after I crowned. So I crowned my successor. Let me think about this. So 2000, I gave up my title. 2001, I crowned her. And then she met my husband to be, right? So she was the Miss New Hampshire I crowned. And she was on a golf course one day and met this very handsome man. And she called me to tell me that she met my future husband. And
that's very big of her. She didn't go for it herself.
No, she was already very much taken by someone that turns out that my now husband had gone to high school with and was on the golf team together. So
it's
everything.
A small
sort of
place, New Hampshire, by the sound of it.
Apparently. Yeah. But yes, so that's, I owe, again, a lot of my life's trajectory back to what happened, you know, when I was 19 and 20.
Okay, so the mentor introduced you to a drug rep.
Yes.
And they go.
Went great. I mean, I listened. I didn't really know a thing that they were talking about at the time. It was all like orthopedic drugs. So not really, I didn't understand the thing. But at the end of their meeting, she spent some time with me and said, you know, what are your interests? You know, this is what I do. And she kind of talked me through how she got there. What does a day in the life look like? You know, what is the industry really? What are they like? You know, what is the biopharmaceutical industry? So she taught me quite a bit and then connected me with a recruiter. And literally within months, it was, well, let me finish and let me graduate. And then I graduated and had a job right out of school.
And that was with Pfizer.
It was.
And you know, you were very diplomatic in the beginning, but I mean, you've been with Pfizer for, what did we decide?
22 years.
Mm-hmm. That's impressive loyalty.
Thank you. It's been a wonderful company and it's been very good to me. And I've learned a lot over the years and I've had a variety of roles. Like, so, you know, the story that we were just talking about, I started my career in sales. And that's how most people start, right? Unless they go to business school or in marketing and kind of move into the industry from either a marketing or a medical side. Most of us start in the field.
Okay, so, you know, we on this side of the fence,
yes,
you know, have an impression that sales reps are there to, you know, flatter us, you know, make us feel good about ourselves. But at the end of the day, say the trade name of the drug as many times as possible in that conversation so that it's embedded in our brain and then hope that it somehow influences our prescribing. Tell me that's not true.
Well, it's not true for me, and I hope it is for, I hope it isn't for most people. That's never how I looked at my sales career. I looked at it as really taking incredible science and data and using it as a teaching opportunity to very busy clinicians, right? And so in the beginning, I was not involved in sort of the cancer sciences, right? I was in sort of what we would call internal medicine, right? Really talking about differentiating your medication, finding the right patient for the right drug. And I think that was probably always sort of the credibility that I work to have as a sales colleague is I was not a salesy type person, but it was really around disease education awareness and finding the right patient for the right therapy.
So we're, you know, one of the things, you know, I think you know that I spent some time in the pharmaceutical industry, but one of the things that I slightly struggled with was what would happen if the competitor had a better drug? And
they do.
Yeah, exactly. So what happens when, you know, you can't suddenly go and sell somebody else's drug, you know, you have to sell what you've got. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're lucky, you work for a company that always has the best drug and it's an easy job. And, but what happens when, you know, you're in a very, I mean, what, you were in cardiovascular drugs or something at the beginning?
I was, yes, in the beginning. So I sold antibiotics and antihistamines and then the cardiovascular space for a while.
Mm-hmm. And that's super crowded. So I mean, I guess in the absence of evidence that you're not the best drug, you have the best drug.
Fair. And I would say, at least from a Pfizer perspective, we always kind of were a leader in our own particular disease areas. But, you know, there have definitely been assets and therapies where over time, as data and science evolved, better therapies would come and sort of replace those. And I think, honestly, Ross, you look at it as there isn't one drug that is the best fit for everybody.
Yeah.
So you find out where it could fit in the landscape, right? Where is there a benefit? And sometimes, honestly, things would come down to like convenience, right? Is it a once a day drug? Is it a four times a day drug, right?
Yeah.
You would find those differentiation marks. But no, I can imagine for people that are selling or representing, you know, therapies that aren't best in class, that it could be a little bit harder. But I think you focus on credibility and integrity.
And how do they measure your success? Is it literally sales?
At that time, probably, yes, from a sales perspective. Right now, and you know, the role that I have now, I think there are different type of metrics that we use. But yes, back then, it's, you know, sales.
So I want to get to that. So how does the sales rep, and no doubt, you know, a successful sales rep, mm-hmm. you know, maybe you get to the point where you're, you know, managing other sales reps, but how do you get this epiphany that you're more than just a salesperson? That you're bringing something, that you're going back to that detachment disorder, and you're the glue that brings people together.
The glue that brings people together. Well, I think like anything, right? You have to do your time. I think I knew very early on, once I joined an industry, I really actually loved sales, right? It was a great way to interact. And like I said, I always came at it from a teaching perspective. I knew based off of my background, right? So remember, molecular biology, but focused on sort of the biology of cancer, that that's where I wanted to end up. And so jumping, right, meet my husband, marry my husband, we move, right? When I moved from New Hampshire to North Carolina, I moved into our oncology space. And initially, again, it was in sales. It was in sort of the breast and colon cancer and GU space. Those were the early programs that Pfizer had. And it was during that time that I really started to interact with significant academicians, right? I covered major NCI centers. I covered the Department of Defense. I covered the federal prison here in North Carolina. So I really started to interact with true experts in their field. And really very early on, I realized, God, there seems to be such a disconnect to what I'm doing in sales, what our expert clinicians are saying they're needing, and what maybe the company may be focusing on, or I will put it, not focusing on, right? Not engaging with, not getting the right questions answered. And so how things worked way back then was if you did a great job, right? If I did a really good job in my sales role, my reward was I could go work ASCO or I could go to one of these big medical conferences. And so I'm pleased to say that I spent many years attending these meetings before I was in the type of role that I'm in now. But it was those types of interactions that allowed me to start making the connections with leadership of, hey, you know what? There is a disconnect of what I'm hearing in the field, right? What clinicians really need, what are some of the challenges that I'm hearing, whether it's with our therapies or just within the disease landscape, and I think we could be doing more. And over time, those conversations, I'm very persistent, Ross.
I'm aware of that.
And I believe that a lot of the communication skills, the things that I learned at a very young age, thank you, Miss America, allowed me to basically create a value proposition to Pfizer to make this role more formal. Because there was something like this, right? There were marketers that worked in different areas that were engaging with key thought leaders, but really to develop sort of the infrastructure from the ground up. And that was the value proposition that I believe I ultimately created in the role that I am today.
I think, did you tell me you were the first thought leader, liaison, whatever your official title is?
Not quite the first. Like I said, there were marketing roles that were sort of doing dual responsibility where they would engage with thought leaders and they had marketing responsibilities. I was the first entity that only came in doing what we would call opinion leader or thought leader engagement, which ultimately has, you know, developed into more formal strategy in creating strategic partnerships. But yeah, at that time, I took over our GU portfolio and our lung cancer portfolio.
And that was, 2017.
Yeah. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's pretend, you know, I'm the young you and, you know, I'm the first time I'm meeting somebody in that position. So explain what a day in the life looks like for you now.
A day in the life looks like for me now. Well, I think it's a lot about building relationships. So again, going full circle to making connections, right? It's really, from my perspective, I need to understand who are the key leaders in the space that I'm working in. So if it's GU cancers, that's GU. If it's lung cancer, right, I'm talking to you, Russ. But who are the key leaders? You know, what are the strategies that my organization is looking to do with our assets, right? That could be from early development all the way through commercialization. So what's currently FDA approved and on brand. And understanding how are we going to drive that franchise forward from a business perspective, but obviously also meet the needs of patients. And to do that, the bridge is the relationship with the key opinion leader internally, the organization. So a day in the life of me, for those that I don't know, right, is around building relationships and understanding what is of interest to you with my company, right? What is interest of you from a science perspective? How are you working with us? How are you not working with us, right? What has been your experience? What we could be doing better and different? But really, it is finding out ways that we can partner together, right? I look at my role, Russ, in sort of two aspects. There's an internal capability of like what I'm doing for my teams, right? What am I doing for the organization? And then there is an external capability where I am your advocate to my company, right? I want to build and foster this relationship so that you not only have a good experience with whatever company I'm working in, but I'm also meeting your needs and making sure that you are connected to the right people from clinical development all the way through leadership. So I really become, I guess in a way, things going full circle, like as an ambassador, right? I'm that point of contact for you externally into my company while I am meeting the business objectives of the organization.
So are you sitting in the room or on the same Zoom call when they're saying, you know, we should or shouldn't do this? And you're going, well, this is what, you know, Dr. So-and-so thinks.
Sometimes I am. It depends on what function is in there. Or what the need is. But more often than not, I am brought into, hey, we're looking to do this partnership, or we're looking to, I want to be careful here about clinical trials because I sit in a commercial organization, so commercial can never direct medical. But there are times where I am brought into conversations where like, look it, we are looking for people that we can partner with in this clinical trial, and this is who we're thinking. And then they will come to me and go, do you agree or do you disagree? And if you disagree and you want someone else, like who, why, right? So it's a lot of me saying this type of person or this personality or this person's expertise is better suited here.
I mean, one of the things, and we've talked about this before, is you are both the beneficiary, for want of a better thing, from pre-existing key opinion leaders, but you are also the means of creating key opinion leaders. Because you become a key opinion leader sometimes because you're standing on stage and presenting some drug company's issues. So it's a sort of self-propagating circle. So how do you find the key opinion leader that's about to become a key opinion leader?
This is really fun. It's actually one of my favorite things to do. Two things, right? I look to who is already a key opinion leader, right? So I'm going to come to you, Ross, as someone who's internationally renowned and revered. And kind of look to see who are you mentoring,
okay,
right? Who are you now passing the baton, if you will, to, right? So that is someone that I clue in, number one. I also look, I would say our kind of developing what we would call emerging thought leaders are those that oftentimes are very socially savvy, right? And sort of the social media, medical, social space, because they're the ones that are posting and, you know, retweeting, if you will. I pay a lot of attention to what happens at medical congresses and who's at posters and abstracts, right? And elevating younger faculty. I do spend a lot of time with our key opinion leaders and saying, right, like who in your fellowship program is really someone that you think I should keep my eye on? So I wouldn't say that I'm sure there's actually probably formal vendors out there that people do this. I tend to take a grassroots approach. Right. I really like to kind of be the boots on the ground and see what's happening and ask the experts and the relationships that I have, whom should I really be paying attention to? But more often than not, Ross, it happens organically, right? You spend enough time in this field, you sort of see who's up and coming, and then you really work to develop those relationships. One, because it could benefit, right, the mutual aligned objectives that an organization may have with a key thought leader. But I also think it's about growing our community.
Now, you've been in this position, as we said, since 2017.
Correct.
How did they measure your success in this role? Because it's not sales.
Yes. So I think it's interesting. It's more softer metrics, right? They're not going to be very quantitative, if you will. Qualitative, I'm sorry. They're qualitative, not quantitative.
Yeah.
And it's more or less around, you know, I have to set goals, like what my goals are. And usually they're aligned to what my brand teams are doing or what the functional teams that I'm supporting, what they're trying to accomplish. But I really sort of measure my success and the metrics that get looked at around, like, not just the number of engagements, but like, who are we engaging? Why are we engaging? How are the engagements that we're having satisfactory externally, right? So sometimes I'll send out surveys, not that anyone wants another email, but a survey, like, are you happy with the work that I provide to you? Are you happy with the relationship that you have with me or the company? And it is about, I guess, whether or not I am able to pull through on the objectives that my teams need. So yes, it's never going to be like a percent growth in a particular situation, but it's much more softer metrics.
After 22 years in Pfizer, you're about to enter a new phase of your life. Do you want to just describe that to the audience?
Sure. Yes. I think it's been a very hard couple of weeks, probably for myself and at Pfizer. So yes, I've had a wonderful career and I owe so much of it to the people and experiences at Pfizer. But I am about to jump into a new area and develop a new set of skills and move into the biotechnology space. So I'm really thrilled that I am going to join Nuvalent out of Cambridge, Massachusetts. And I get to do for Nuvalent what it is that I love to do and what I do best, but to do it in a leadership capacity and build out a team, really building from the ground up. What does thought leader strategic partnerships look like? What does it look like for an up and coming biotech company? And I am so thrilled to be back, hopefully, in the lung cancer space very, very soon with all of you. So it's a wonderful opportunity. It is bittersweet to leave 22 years behind, but it is really important for me to grow and develop and to continue what I love to do. I think I would leave you with that very few people probably get to have a job that they're also very passionate about. I would hope that more people in the world do things that they're passionate about, but sometimes I don't think that happens. I love what I get to do every day. I think I'm blessed to have the opportunity to do it, and I'm really thrilled to take on this next partnership with Nuvalent.
Will it leave you time for singing?
Oh, 100%. So there's a lot more singing happening. We only touched briefly on that, but I do have a wonderful jazz quartet. We have an album out already. This is my selfish plug. You can go stream and listen to it anywhere.
What's it called? Go on. Let's do the full plug. Let's do
it. Right. So the full plug is my name, Lauren Meehan, which is my maiden name, M-E-E-H-A-N. And the album is called Nature Boy, and it is on every streaming platform. But we are hopeful to get back into the studio this year as a jazz quartet and release another record together. I am surrounded by immensely talented musicians. I just get to show up and, again, do what I love to do.
Well, I am thrilled that I get to experience that secondhand. Lauren, thank you so much for sharing your journey with us.
Thank you so much. I'm humbled and honored.
You've been listening to How This Is Building Me with host me, D. Ross Camage. Rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts, and follow us on @drcamage on Blue Sky for additional commentary.